Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery for East County Magazine and KNSJ. The California Highway Patrol has responded to our inquiry regarding a truck with oversized load that broke down on Highway 94 for 2 weeks recently. The 231-foot-long load was traveling on a highway with a 75-foot limit. It was also over-wide and at times obstructed both lanes on a winding road to Tecate. The load was a compressor used for mining and pipeline operations. It originated in Denver and was ultimately bound for Ensenada, Mexico. Residents had complained of long delays and wanted to know why this truck was not routed through San Ysidro or Otay crossings, which have better roadways. Sergeant Dave Dreher with the CHP said he believed the ultimate destination was Tecate when he approved the route. Asked if he would route such a large load through a different port of entry in the future, if the destination allowed that option, he said, absolutely. But even if he had known that the load was bound for Ensenada on the Pacific coast, the options were still limited. Rito Kaufman, vice president of SkyTruck in Los Angeles, which contracted out the hauling job, had a simple explanation. He told East County Magazine that the San Ysidro port does not allow cargo and that both the Otay and Calexico border crossings have height and width limits that prohibited this large load from crossing at those locations. He added that authorities are in the process of making these gateways more modern at Otay to allow larger loads, but it could be another year or so before that's open. If there was a route that wasn't so difficult, we would have taken it, he added. It is unclear whether other ports of entry in Texas, New Mexico, or Arizona might have been options, or whether this equipment could have been shipped in an ocean routing to the new port in Ensenada as an alternative. While traveling along Highway 94, this truck broke drive shafts and rear ends connected to the axles. It broke down in Dulzura on August 6th and once again a few feet down the road on August 7th, where it sat until August 14th. Residents have said the rig slowed traffic for over 50 hours, causing detours of up to a couple of hours in some cases. The CHP spokesman disputes that timeline. He says the truck sat approximately 20 hours blocking one lane, but that both lanes were never blocked due to the breakdown. However, both lanes were blocked at times as the truck moved slowly forward, with an extra wide load blocking both lanes, causing some motorists to turn around in frustration and go the long way around. Removing the broken-down rig was delayed because the trucking company determined it would need two more trucks, providing a total of two push trucks and two pull trucks, or tractors. That required getting a new permit from Caltrans. The full load, which now measured over 300 feet with the additional two trucks, was moved the night of August 20th and arrived at Tecate on the U.S. side of the border at 7:30 a.m. on August 21st, where it is still waiting an escort over the border and final approval from Mexican authorities. The port of entry will open at night to allow the load to cross and avoid inconveniencing international border travelers, we have learned. A SIG alert was not issued until many hours into the situation, much to the consternation of local residents, and concerns remain over blocking evacuation routes for residents should a wildfire or other emergency have occurred.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guide, host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won 7 Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for exposing fraud and corruption. Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso.
John Mattis here. I've got some really shady deals to talk about. And the word mortgage modification comes to mind when you talk about shady deals, because mortgage modifications around the country have been ripe for ripoff artists, con men. All the industry is full of those kind of people. And if you're a homeowner and you're underwater, do not, whatever you do, do not go to a commercial mortgage modification broker, whatever they want to call themselves. They're charlatans, they're snake oil salesmen. They will take your money. Now, having said that, I'm going to tell you about the poster child for mortgage modification fraud. His name's Sam Suleman. Now, maybe you remember his name. Back in 2006, I investigated him for mortgage fraud. Back in 2006, he took control of a number of properties here in San Diego, $30 million of properties that were put in bogus names. He took the rents out of the properties, let those properties go into foreclosure. Well, he never was prosecuted for that. All he was prosecuted for was in September of 2006, when I had exposed him in a number of exposés on television. He attacked me in broad daylight and tried to kill me. It was televised around the world, and he became infamous and famous, for that matter, and ultimately went to jail for beating me up and attempting to kill me. But what's so interesting is he never went to jail for the mortgage fraud. Those homes all went into foreclosure, and we, the taxpayer, of course, had to pay for every single one of them. Now, fast forward. People like Mr. Suleman left jail. Well, when they left jail, what are they going to do with their lives? They're going to turn to mortgage modification fraud. Mortgage modification fraud is a wonderful thing. You get people underwater, you take their last little bit of money, and you tell them not to pay the bank. In other words, you make them lose their home for you to steal $3,000 from them. Mr. Suleman was doing that along with many other people. He did that across Southern California when he came out of jail. And lo and behold, finally, and I say finally, he was prosecuted for that and went back to jail. Now, none of the victims got their money back. Many of them lost their homes. But now let's fast forward to the present. When he's come out of jail again, what do you think he's doing? Well, of course, he's doing the same thing. Now we hear that he has a group called the Simplify Law Group, and he's been accused of taking money from homeowners all over the East Coast, promising them mortgage modifications, and of course, not delivering. So that leaves homeowners losing their homes, losing $3,000 to Mr. Suleman, and he's going along his merry way, enjoying his life, pocketing money. Now, the moral of the story is crime pays. White-collar crime really pays. Now, whether you're at Wall Street or you're working Southern California mortgage modification scheme, we have not seen aggressive prosecution of white-collar crime here in America because our prosecutors are underfunded and understaffed. So my recommendation to homeowners, to people looking to take advantage of things they see offered to them, if it looks good, if it smells good, it's probably too good to be true. And I caution homeowners, I caution consumers, watch out. The scammers, schemers are out there. You got to be careful.
This is Lynn Moneyfires bringing you the Tribal Beat, covering the news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery, and today I'm guest hosting the Tribal Beat. My guest today is Bonnie LaChapa. Bonnie is a recipient of KNSJ's People's Microphone Awards for her community service in many different areas. She is an elected council member of the Barona Band of Mission Indians and an elected member of the Lakeside Union School District Board. And most recently, she was named Citizen of the Year by the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce. She is also a committee member on the 43rd Annual Barona Powwow. Welcome, Bonnie, to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm terrific, thank you. Tell us about this year's powwow. When is it going to be held and where?
It's coming up fast. It's going to be August 30th through September 1st. That's a Sunday, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And on Friday, we have grand entry at 7. On Saturday, we'll have a grand entry in the afternoon. And we usually do on Saturday the children. So if you like to watch the children dance, you need to come during the day on a Saturday. We usually have the elders later that night on a Saturday night. Yep, we'll have dancing all 3 days, and it'll end on Sunday evening, probably around 11 o'clock at night. That's when we hand out the prize money to all the winners that have won all the dance contests through the weekend.
Now, it's an absolutely spellbinding event. I've been to it many times. It's held out at the Barona baseball field on the reservation. If you go past the casino and past the museum, it's there on the left.
Yep, right through the dip and on the left-hand side, there's plenty of free parking, and it's on our baseball field, so it's kind of tucked behind.
So what's the address?
1095 Barona Road.
How did the powwow get started?
The powwow started many years ago. My Uncle Boxy and my Aunt Joan belonged to a dance troupe, and their group wanted more opportunities to share their dance, because it's a social event, too. It's family and friends coming together to dance. And so they started the Barona Powwow on the reservation with their dance troupe. And for many years, probably till about 8 years ago, the dance troupe put it together. It was all volunteers, not necessarily all tribal members from Barona. There were Indians from other reservations. My Aunt Joan was from Oklahoma. They put it together, a lot of hard work, volunteering, spending all year trying to raise the funds. And about 8 years ago, the tribe saw the benefit of it as a dance troupe. And as the years went off, there was less and less people that belonged to the club. The tribe decided to take it over. So now there's a powwow committee. And the powwow committee is made up of about 4 tribal members. And then with the help of our staff at the casino, we put this powwow together every year. So for me, I'm a newbie. I've only been doing it for about 8 years, but I love it. I will be there all weekend long. It's a fun tradition, being with family and friends, talking about things that happened the past powwow.
Mm-hmm.
Just meeting people that are out of town, Oklahoma, Canada.
Yeah, now people come from all across the country and even outside of the country, tribes from just about everywhere, I think.
Yes.
What draws people from so far away to come to this particular powwow, Bonnie?
I think with our powwow, they love our event. They love the setting on the reservation. If you've never been to my reservation, it is beautiful.
Yeah, all the oak trees.
And dance competition, the money. We have, you know, a lot of Indian dancers do a powwow trail. So they start in the summer and they'll start with our powwow and then move on to other powwows that are in our area, dancing for competition and money. And it's just a tradition. Mm-hmm. And so.
And they're all in their full regalia, traditional tribal wear and some fancy dress. And now, the powwow is free and it's open to the public. What can visitors expect to see and to experience if they come?
Well, it's open to the public. You will be amazed by the drums and the Indian songs that they sing. It's very moving. We make sure that the drums are super loud. We have, you know, a lot of speakers, and you'll get a full feel of what it's like for you to be in that whole feeling of the drums. It almost makes your heart just, you know, jump out of your chest, the drums. And I love it. I look forward to it every year. 7 o'clock, if you get there at 7 o'clock, you find a seat in our grandstands and grand entry. And grand entry is amazing. You'll see all of the dance categories will come in and proceed into the main arena, and they'll dance around the drum, and you'll see all the groups. There's fancy dance, straight dance, shawl, jingle, and you'll see all ages, and it's amazing. It's beautiful. And if you've never come, coming to Barona, it's easy. Some powwows, you have a lot of parking and walking. Ours is easy parking. You park in the field, and boom, you're in the arena.
Now, can you tell us, for the non-Native Americans that are listening, the significance of some of the dances that people will be seeing?
The fancy dance would be more like a war dance, something like traditional, like going to war, and the fancy dancers are the real fast ones, the ones that you might be more familiar with on TV. And they have 2 bustles on their back, and the bustles are what the feathers are attached to. And then you have straight dancers that just have the single bustle, and they move in a slower beat, a slower drum. And we have the grass dancers, who are their regalia is made of a lot of yarn or ribbon, and they were called in to trample down the grass before a powwow or an event. We have jingle dancers are the females, and they make a wonderful jingle noise.
With bells on the costumes.
Bells on the costumes. When I was a girl, the girls weren't allowed to do fancy dance.
Really?
But so then I think as time grew on, and some of the girls wanted to do like a fancy dance, so an Indian woman, this is the story I've been told, had a vision of a butterfly dancing in the wind and moving around. And the movement of that butterfly gave her an idea to create a fancy shawl. So the women can do a fancy shawl dress dance that is very fast and upbeat and
beautiful. And I've seen that done. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, and it's more modern. And when I was a young girl, we didn't have that at a powwow. So those are amazing. It's given a nice twist for the younger girls who wanted to, you know, enjoyed watching them mm-hmm. the men do the fancy dance, which is really fast.
Are there rules that visitors should be aware of to be respectful of the tribal traditions, such as photography limitations?
Yes, you're allowed to take photography, and most of the time if you ask a dancer to take a picture, they're more than welcoming. The only thing that we ask is that no flash photography during competition, because at night when they're competing, and the flash will sometimes distract them, and they will get off beat, and they're being judged by points, and
right.
especially fancy dancers, when they're dancing and the drum ends, they have to end and be motionless at the end of the drum too, or they get points marked down. So
very good to know. But there, during the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, there are some competition dances during the daylight hours, correct?
Yes, there is. There's competition. Our children normally do during the day. So we'll have all our children during the day on Saturday and Sunday.
And those are fine with photography. As
yes.
Anything, as long as there's no flash, you can take photographs.
You can
bring your fast film or
yeah, bring your fast film and you'll get some amazing shots. No dogs allowed in the arena, and no alcohol or weapons, drugs in the arena.
Or cigarettes,
yes. But outside the arena, mm-hmm. in the camping areas, because we do have free camping too available, mm-hmm. you're allowed to have alcohol out there. It's just not to
just
in
a
the arena.
Safe family yes. environment inside.
Yeah.
And in addition, we should add, this is a wonderful opportunity to look at some of the vendors that come. You have all kinds of Native American crafts, foods.
Last year we had 60 vendors, arts and craft vendors, and then we had 15 informational booths, and we had 13 food booths.
Many of these are Native American crafts, specifically the people that make the Indian jewelry.
And we have arts and crafts people coming from Arizona, from Oklahoma. And they drive. They'll
yeah.
drive all day, and they'll arrive on Friday.
Yeah, I've seen Kachina dolls and yeah. moccasins and
yeah,
all kinds
to
of
sell
things.
Their wares. If you do any beading or any arts and crafts, you'll find all kinds of supplies, mm-hmm. beading supplies. There's just some beautiful artwork. And
I do my holiday shopping there every year for certain yeah. relatives that love that stuff.
yeah. And you'll get to have an Indian taco. We usually have regular tacos and we'll have
Indian fry bread,
and you can get that with some strawberries and whipped cream, and it's amazing.
Well, there you go. And we should note that the Barona Band of Mission Indians traces its roots back, 10,000 years or more here, Bonnie?
Yes, we've been around a long time. We were hunter-gatherers. You know, we traveled from the desert to the mountains to the sea. There were no borders. I mm-hmm. actually have Kumeyaay family right across the border that still speak our language, and we've been here a long time. We have a beautiful museum. If you ever want to learn more about the Native Indians here, especially my tribe, we have a museum that's open to the public Tuesday through Saturday from 11 to 5 every day.
And it's a marvelous museum. You've served on the board of that, I understand.
Yes, I am. I'm the co-chair of our museum. It's a small museum, but it's got some really nice exhibits. We're getting ready right now. In September, we're going to be previewing a brand new exhibit called Sports on Our Reservation. So it's going to follow all the history of all our athletic people. Because when I grew up as a young girl, baseball and sports was very important to our tribe. We were a ranching tribe, cattle, and softball, fast pitch softball. I can remember mm-hmm. going all over with my uncles, watching him play fast pitch softball at all the reservations.
Well, that sounds great. Now, is the museum open during the powwow, Bonnie?
The museum will be open during the powwow.
And it's right
on Saturday.
Very close to it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
on Friday and Saturday. It's closed on Sunday and Monday, mm-hmm. but it'll be open on Friday and Saturday.
Well, very good. So people can come out and
enjoy the museum
will
have a booth. They usually have a booth out in the informational area
mm-hmm. well, that's
during
good to
the
know.
Powwow, too.
Now, speaking of information, Bonnie, where can people find more information about the powwow and also about the museum?
If you just Google Barona Tribe, it'll take you right to our webpage. Our webpage is beautiful. We have all the categories out. There's a little tab for the powwow. Just click on the powwow tab. It'll give you all the information about the powwow. And there's a museum tab, and it's really easy to use. And you'll learn a little bit about the history of the tribe, what we do in our government, how our government works, because we are a sovereign nation. It's a good website that we're constantly updating.
Very good. So just Google Barona Tribe for more information. And also, we will have information on the powwow at the website at eastcountymagazine.org, as well as on our calendar section. Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Rebecca Williamson for KNSJ in East County Magazine with an important crime beat report. The San Diego Sheriff has issued a warning to the public to be careful when buying or selling items on Craigslist. Numerous crimes in our region have been linked to Craigslist. More recently, on July 29th, a man who answered a Craigslist ad for a cell phone was accosted at gunpoint by two suspects demanding money in the 4S Ranch area. The victim fled to a nearby sheriff's substation, and the subjects were arrested. In 2011, San Diego police arrested a suspect for a series of robberies of people who responded to Craigslist ads for iPads. Also, a La Mesa man was robbed and assaulted when he went to a park to meet a seller advertising computers on Craigslist. A convicted sex offender confessed to drugging and killing a San Diego State University freshman after meeting her on Craigslist, where she advertised tutoring services. In addition, a teenager attempting to purchase an item offered for sale legally on Craigslist was shot and killed in a San Diego neighborhood. The sheriff offers these tips to protect yourself if you buy or sell items on Craigslist. Set up an appointment during the day. Insist on a public meeting place, since criminals don't want witnesses. Don't go alone. Bring a friend. Tell another friend or family member where you're going. Bring your cell phone to call 911 if necessary. Don't carry a large amount of cash. Don't buy from a seller who only lists an email address. This is a red flag that the seller has something to hide. Never go to a second location. If you arrived at a meeting place and the seller asks you to go to another place, this should raise some serious red flags. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. You're better off passing it up. Trust your instincts. If anything seems suspicious, out of place, or just doesn't feel right, leave.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This Labor Day weekend brings you the 3-day Barona Indian Powwow event and a 4-day arts event put on by the Julian Arts Guild. September Song is the name of the fine arts show this weekend in Julian. The 4-day Julian Art Guild's fine arts show will include local and regional artists of various mediums, oil, acrylic, and watercolor paintings, drawings in pen, pencil, and pastel, photography, printmaking, ceramics, jewelry, collage, and assemblage, glass, mosaic, sculpture, and more. The theme, September Song, will be reflected in landscapes and other creative works. The show runs from Friday, August 30th through Monday, September 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. each day at the Julian Town Hall on Main Street in Julian. The opening reception will be held on Friday, August 30th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. when you can meet the artists. Admission to the art show is free, and each day different artists will be available to talk about their work. Barona's 43rd annual powwow takes place this weekend starting Friday, August 30th and ending on Sunday, September 1st at the Barona Baseball Field at Barona Indian Reservation in Lakeside. There is free admission and camping. Contest dancing includes gourd dancing, hand drum contest, and men's fancy dance. A 76th annual barbecue event is taking place in Descanso this Sunday, September 1st, at Our Lady of Light Church on Riverside Drive. The barbecue features food, pies, craft, and game booths, and entertainment by the Honky Tonk Kings. The fun begins at 11 a.m. and continues till 6 p.m. Hacienda Casablanca in El Cajon features musicians each Tuesday evening, as well as special pricing. This Tuesday, guitarist and vocalist Michael J. Dwyer will be playing 60s through 80s acoustic rock, folk, and American covers, as well as his originals. He will be playing from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Wednesday night concerts in the garden continue at Cottonwood Golf Club through the fall at their golf course in the Rancho San Diego area of El Cajon. Concerts in the Garden, which started this summer, has become so popular that it's being extended through fall. Held every Wednesday night from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., the event features free live music from one of San Diego's leading bands. Barbecue and drinks are available for purchase. The entertainment changes each week. And on August 28th, Kid Tater's All-Star Dance Jam takes the stage. The Bill McGee Blues Band will be playing for the Dinner and a Concert series at the Prescott Promenade in El Cajon this Friday, August 30th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And the last concert in the Sunset Summer Concert series at Grossmont Center is Friday, August 30th at 6 p.m. and will feature the Blue Frog Band. Their music includes blues and rock. Don't forget your dancing shoes. The concert location is the Macy's Courtyard in the Grossmont Center Shopping Mall. In Ramona this Saturday, August 31st, there will be a 2013 Summer Reserve Beer Pairing Dinner and Bottle Release at the Chuck Alec Independent Brewers. The event includes a four-course dinner paired with Chuck Alec beers, new beer releases in the tasting room, and two bottles of the 2013 Summer Reserve to take home. Chuck Alec Independent Brewers is located on Main Street in Ramona. Rockin' San Diego. Experience rich geologic beauty and history on a trail guide-led walk in Mission Trails Regional Park. Learn how the gorge was formed and other marvels of nature. Meet at the Visitor Center this Wednesday, August 28th at 9:30 a.m. Please see our calendar for additional hike dates through September and the beginning of October. Also at Mission Trails Regional Park, learn about Birds, Bees, and Me, and the food chain from producers to consumers, and other topics in nature exploring the natural world on a trail guide-led walk. Meets at the Visitor's Center on Saturday, August 31st. The hike goes from 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. This same hike is also offered on Sunday, September 1st, at the same time and location. These and other events are all listed on our calendar and in the Festivals and Events section of www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interests, not special interests. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM in Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
Last week, an East County Magazine investigation uncovered links between massive dust storms in Ocotillo and across the Southwest and the recent construction of industrial-scale wind and solar facilities that scraped bare desert soil in these areas. Our findings have been reported by United Press International. So today we're going to replay our radio version of that story, and you can find more at our website on www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. A second dust storm has struck Ocotillo on August 25th, just 2 days after an earlier dust storm swept through this desert community. Dust billowed thousands of feet into the air,
dwarfing 500-foot-tall wind turbines. East County Magazine photographer Jim Pelley was in the middle of the storm and shot video that you can see on our site, www.eastcountymagazine.org. Resident Diane Tucker said she watched all afternoon from her dining room window as the storm descended to engulf the home of Pelley and neighbors. They were engulfed, she said. You couldn't even see over there. The dust storms that struck Ocotillo originated from the east, coming from Arizona, according to witnesses. An East County Magazine investigation has found that in the last 10 years, over 100 dust storms have been reported in Arizona, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Dust storms have also increased in Texas and other areas of the Southwest in recent years. What's causing the recent flurry of dust storms? Some blame global warming, but there is another possible explanation. Our report found a correlation between construction of industrial-scale wind and solar projects that scrape bare the desert soil and outbreaks of dust storms. Since 2007, Arizona has added over 600 megawatts of industrial solar power, including over 500 megawatts in 2010 and 2011, shortly before the massive Phoenix dust storm made national news. That storm was called a haboob after the dust storms in the Sahara that are similar. Arizona had just completed its first industrial-scale wind farm, Dry Lake Wind in Mojave County, northeast of Phoenix, shortly before the haboob struck, in addition to adding a lot of industrial solar. In October of 2011, Lubbock, Texas was hit by the worst dust storm to strike inside the United States in decades. Lubbock is close to several industrial-scale wind projects, including the world's largest wind farm, Roscoe, which has 627 wind turbines. Combined, these wind projects near Lubbock have many thousands of wind turbines, and each one required massive grading and excavation of fragile desert soils. Edie Harmon, a wildlife biologist, had this to say after viewing photos of the Ocotillo dust storms. "Looks like the Dust Bowl or haboob dust storms that hit Arizona," she said, noting that such storms can be associated with increased exposure to valley fever fungal spores, especially after it rains. Valley fever has reached epidemic proportions in Arizona and California, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. Valley fever concerns have also been raised by Kevin Emmerich of Basin and Range Watch, an environmental organization. Emmerich is concerned that large-scale wind and solar projects are increasing not only dust storms, which can cause respiratory problems, but also exposure to valley fever, a potentially deadly illness. He sent a photo to East County Magazine showing dust at NextEra's Genesis Solar Project in Riverside County, California. He wrote, "Perfect storm scenario on this one, too. It is about 3,000 acres of 100% grading." He added that he observed construction not being halted despite 35-mile-an-hour winds when the BLM had said the contractor was supposed to halt construction at 30-mile-an-hour winds. He added, "This is common out there. It is so bad you can't see through the dust, and this is an area that has several valley fever incidents." Valley fever symptoms develop after 1 to 4 weeks of exposure and can include fever, muscle ache, cough, headache, shortness of breath, tiredness, and skin lesions. Severe cases can result in death, particularly in vulnerable individuals, such as those with compromised immune systems and the elderly. A blood test is needed to diagnose the disease. Dust storms have potential to blow valley fever spores hundreds of miles away from where they originated. During the Cedar Fire, valley fever was diagnosed among patients in Chula Vista. The spores are believed to have blown in from desert areas during the storm, the firestorm. With multiple industrial-scale wind and solar projects planned in San Diego's East County on high desert and agricultural lands, the potential for dust storms that could reach San Diego is very real, but has been largely blown off by officials approving wind and solar projects in our area.
Coming up next, it's the Offbeat Report, with Rebecca Williamson traveling off the beaten track to find some fascinating stories from the offbeat to the upbeat.
This is Rebecca Williamson here with East County Magazine, and I'm interviewing Rudy Reyes, who has a variety of accomplishments to his credit, one of which is he's a survivor of the Cedar Fire, and he survived over 70% burns on his body. Can you explain a little bit about the experience you had with the fires?
I'm in the Smithsonian, recognized as one of the worst injured, the hero of the 2003 San Diego fires. Because of that, I've toured and spoken and tried to help a lot of people, and I've become more of an advocate to give back. Because again, I survived one of the biggest fires in human history.
And then another thing that you also do is you're an advocate for the disabled. Can you explain more on what you've done there?
I've gone through on the disabled level and tried to help people understand that, look, just because I have physical issues doesn't mean my life is over, right? So I've tried to make other people understand that if they see me on TV and they see me doing good things, they can too.
But you're cooking up something else different now. You appeared on the MasterChef TV show. Can you go into a little bit about how you actually were inspired to do it and the whole procedure, the whole timeline of how it happened?
Speaking on the disability level and the inspiration, well, let's be honest. The last winner was a blind lady. She was completely blind, and that inspired me to say, hey, look, if she can do something, I can do something. So when I saw them advertising here in San Diego saying that we're going to come to San Diego and do auditions, I'm going to jump in and see what I can do. So I went online and put in the application, and for the most part, kind of forgot about it. And then the week before the audition, they called me up, and they said that we saw your application, and we'd like to see what you can do, and we'd like to see you come in. We understand that you have burn issues, so we're going to give you VIP access. Well, there I am with VIP access, and I don't know what I'm going to cook for these people. So I'm figuring I'm a rarity. Let's cook them a rarity. And I know how to do Indian tacos, Native American tacos, Indian fry bread.
Rudy, if you could explain a little bit more about your own ethnic background.
Honestly, I like to call myself indigenous. I'm from here. I'm a mix of Mexican and local Kumeyaay Indians. So I'm from the Barona Band of Native American Indians. And that makes me as indigenous as you can get. I've got degrees in archaeology. That's my background. I used to get extra credit in college for teaching kids how to make fry bread. So I went ahead and made fry bread and got it to the audition within a half hour. So it was still warm and fresh because I had VIP access. So when I got there and presented my dish, oh, they loved it. They had other judges coming in to try it out because it was such a rarity they'd never had this. Next part audition is we line up the people that made it through the first one and get your story. Well, as you can tell, I've got a compelling story. And the personal interview, they ask you more personal questions. Why are you doing this? What are you doing it for? And for me, it wasn't about me. It was about the other people out there to see me and to understand that just because, you know, yeah, I'm burned. Yeah, I'm missing fingers. Yeah, my fingers are fused. They don't move the way they used to. But I can still cook and I can still do and I can still make a quality life. And that's what it was about.
And explain a little bit about your products that you brought and also the recipe, if you would share that.
Ah, you want me to give away my recipes?
I do.
Okay. So, again, in making a Native American taco, you got to make the fry bread first. I made the fry bread with, let's say, 2 cups of flour, half a spoonful or a tablespoonful of salt, a little bit of water, a little bit of milk, and you mix that all together. Don't forget some oil, just about a teaspoon of oil, and you mix that all together until it makes a nice dough. And then that dough you flatten out into basically a tortilla. You get some corn oil nice and hot, and you fry it up till it becomes a big poofy bread, right? And then that gets set aside. The meat consisted, for me at least on the show, of buffalo meat. I was lucky in the fact that I sourced it out, and they had it for me available. Unfortunately, buffalo meat isn't exactly fatty, so it didn't keep its rendering well when it went through the actual show. But that's beside the point. Then from there, I made a fresh pico salsa. Now that salsa consisted of chopped tomatoes, garlic, onion, yellow pepper, cut up into it nice and deep, and then lime juice to make it that savory salsa, along with about a spoonful of salt. That, along with a little bit of lettuce, some aged Monterey Jack cheese, and you put together a taco. Just a generalized taco. So now I put down my bread, some beans, because the beans just adds the stickiness so that your meat doesn't fall off the bread. And then you add the salsa, some lettuce, cheese, and now you got a taco, and just fold it up and start eating.
And how much did you have to prepare? Like how many, with a quantity of how many tacos that you did at the audition?
At the audition, I made plenty of tacos. Matter of fact, I made so many bread that I was giving them away to other people to try out because they had never tried it at the auditions. I purposely made it like that to be able to give away and be able to have extra. It's a tradition we do. It's a tradition that goes back to Native Americanness that when you do something like this, you give it away.
And then was it also the same with other people who were auditioning? Did you get to sample some of the other people's foods?
A lot of them weren't. And a lot of them were very quiet and hush-hush about their recipes and techniques because they didn't want you to be competitive with them. You know, this is a big competitive, 100 down to 1. Me, I was the exact opposite. I was there to make friends.
Now, you did the actual audition locally in a major hotel.
Right.
And then what happened after that?
They did the first auditions here in San Diego. So they had to go to all the other cities in the United States to do their auditions before they decided. So we're talking another 2.5 months passed before I actually got a confirmation saying, we chose you. They took us up to L.A., and we stayed at another hotel there. We were sequestered for about 2 weeks while we did the show. I gotta say, thank God I didn't make it much further, because I didn't know these TV shows were as hardcore as they are. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you're not done until 9 o'clock at night, filming and taping, and you're on your feet the whole time. My toes were going white from bad circulation. I'm glad I didn't stay.
Okay, so you go on the show, and you hear the music from the show, and that's the go.
Now they're going to let me go and let me cook. And then I was free, and I knew exactly what I was doing, and I was having fun while I was cooking. The real problem I had is we had a short circuit of an oven, and an hour and a half passed between when I presented to the judges and when I had cooked. My food, for the most part, wasn't going to work, and I knew that going in. So I decided on the other end to make it a good presentation at the very least, and make it about what I had in my background. The judges loved me. Let's be honest, two of them loved my food. The one from New York really didn't, right? And he was just because he's from New York. You kind of expect that. He's got a higher class taste. My food is rustic. We're talking Indian food, right?
So Gordon Ramsay is legendary. What was it like to meet Gordon Ramsay, and was it intimidating?
Don't be fooled by the gentleman. He's not what he shows in Hell's Kitchen. In Hell's Kitchen, he makes himself a monster on purpose. It's Hell's Kitchen. The show I was on was MasterChef. He's really nice. Got to meet him, talk with him, shake hands. He liked me, right? It's just because of the problem we had, he couldn't let me go through. So he chose to allow me to come back if I so choose.
So, do you swap recipes with Gordon? I mean, do you sort of like pick his brain about, hey, Gordon, you know, what can you give to me?
He was very honest with me and told me he had never mastered a fried bread recipe. It's something he had never gotten down, and he'd like to go spend some time with Native Americans to get it down. Along with that, Graham Elliott, the bigger gentleman, the other of the three chefs, he loved my food. And he invited me to Chicago to go train with him. So in a few months, I'm planning to go to Chicago and spend some time with Graham Elliott and learn from him.
And what other projects have sort of come to the forefront in terms of what you want to introduce in this culinary line to people with the Native American dishes?
Okay, well, that's the idea there. Look, I come from a background where we have staples. We have certain things that a lot of these other cultures that are right around us have never tried. Like, I'm sure you've never heard of shawi, acorn mush. It's a tradition here in San Diego. And not a lot of people have had it because it's a rarity. I know how to make shawi. It takes a lot of tanning and a lot of effort, but I know how to make it.
And what is in it?
It's acorn, which has been ground down into a fine powder and then tannin leached from it so it doesn't have any of the acids that are in acorns naturally. And then that you turn into basically a flour or a mush to make a bread with. It's a little sticky, but it is good. Every tradition, every culture has their staples. My plan is in the next year or so, I want to go around to these different cultures and learn their staples and then bring them back to our society to be able to teach them to others. That's really the ethno of it, of the food, to try to bring back archaeologically so that we don't lose it culturally.
Now, your show, the episode that you were on, aired recently in June.
In June.
Where would you recommend for listeners to go see it again?
You can find it all over the place. It's on YouTube, Hulu, you name it. I'm Series 4, Episode 2. I was in the first night of the show. So they used me for a teaser, a commercial cliffhanger. I'm well known. I made a lot of fans off of that show. I can't wait to go back now. Every year I go to a gathering of burn survivors. I blew it up for the burn community. So when I go back there in a few months, I'm about to have fun, get to see all my friends, teach them some new stuff, and be like, hey, look what I did for us. Because for someone like me to get on a show like that and to present is good.
So, you have a recipe, a signature recipe that you've taken to the forefront on
Correct.
TV. Now, when you go to the store, when you go around the community, do you get hit up for the recipe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've had people see me two aisles down in a row and kind of stalk me for a little bit. And then all of a sudden come up and be like, did I see you on TV? Yeah, you saw me on TV. I'm that guy. Oh, nice to meet you. How'd you do that? What's the recipe of this? I'm like, oh, okay, you want my right here? I'll write it down real quick for you, right? And don't get me wrong, writing it down isn't going to exactly teach you how to make it. So I've got a Vimeo video that I actually have out there where I've taught, where I made the application for MasterChef and I taught them on that show how to make my fry bread. It's available if you look me up on Vimeo.com. Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O. And that site allows for small people to put up their own local videos just to have it up. It's on there so you can learn how to make my empanadas. You can learn how to make my fry bread because the same recipe I make my empanadas is the same recipe I make my fry bread.
Thank you.
No problem.
You can see more of Rudy's interview and more about Rudy at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk today about some plants you can plant to bring in hummingbirds. Everybody loves them. Nobody wants to fill those feeders. They get ants in them. They get bees in them. They get mold in them. And someday I'll convince my husband to quit putting sugar water in them and feeding them, because there's enough in my yard to keep every hummingbird in East County quite happy for quite a while. So what do you want to put in your yard that will bring in the hummingbirds? My favorite plant is a cultivar of a native plant. It is called Galvezia firecracker. If you go to most nurseries nowadays, this plant has become so popular that you can get it. Just ask for firecracker, which is different than Russellia. It's a Galvezia, G-A-L-V-E-Z-I-A. This is a plant that gets to be about 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has red tubular flowers. And that's the key, isn't it? Red tubular flowers. That's what brings in the hummingbirds. They love it. Can't stay away from them. This is a much more manageable and nice plant than the Cape honeysuckle with the big orange flowers and the plant that gets to be 15 feet tall and 20 feet wide and goes everywhere and is a big floppy mess. Try a firecracker and see what you think. You can grow it in the sun, in the shade, in part sun, in part shade, with a lot of water or with just a little bit of water, and it will be fine. I have a neighbor who grows it under pepper trees, and the gardeners come every week and prune them into little round balls, and they never really get to bloom, and those trees have suffered through that for the last few years without a single one of them dying. Now, that's what I would call an obliging plant. Another good plant that will bring in lots and lots of wildlife to your garden, and hummingbirds especially, is called California fuchsia. It's called Epilobium. Some of you may have known it in the past as Zauschneria. What a great name. So there's a good password for you, Zauschneria. Who's going to use a word like that for their password? Zauschnerias, or Epilobiums, California fuchsia, are a gray plant, and they have a bright orange-red tubular flower. Once again, great for hummingbirds, really keeps them happy. This is a plant that will actually spread slightly on its own and will get by even if something bad happens to the irrigation and nobody irrigates it for 6 weeks or 6 months. It won't die. It'll be fine. Anytime you go to a nursery, look around and look for the plants that have the red tubular flowers. That's the key to hummingbirds. Now, my friend Maureen Austin, who puts on the Sage and Songbirds Festival every year, says there's two kinds of wildlife-attracting plants out there. There's ice cream cones, which we're talking about now. These are the tubular-shaped flowers that the hummingbirds like. Or there's pizzas, and pizzas are the flat flowers, the daisy-type flowers, that you see butterflies landing on. If you think about butterfly bush, Buddleia, which brings in all sorts of cute little butterflies, it also is fragrant. It's known as summer lilac here, or butterfly bush. Then if you take a close look at those purple spikes that grow on that, that bring in the butterflies, you'll see a whole bunch of little bitty flowers. And that's what the butterflies are landing on. That's what they like. So that's a great one. Probably the best butterfly plant that you can come up with, though, is always going to be the butterfly weed, milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. It has orange and red flowers on it, and it just grows like a weed in your garden. Not invasive, just reseeds very effectively. You will know that you have succeeded when you see interesting-looking green caterpillars all over the plant, eating every leaf. In my garden, I pick them off and I move them to another milkweed after they eat all the leaves off one. I don't try to fight them because they're going to turn into monarch butterflies. So my garden is full of monarch butterflies, which I consider to be flying flowers. So keep in mind, butterfly milkweed is a great plant to add to your garden repertoire.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Antonio F. Viana, author and educator.
My guest has written 20 books and 6 screenplays since 2003. He's also created 3 popular workshops: Re-Careering at Any Age, How to Write a Book and Get Published, and How to Write a Screenplay. Welcome, Antonio. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for inviting me.
You have written 18 novels and 2 nonfiction books in a period of 10 years, and yet you also work as instructor and area chair of business at the University of Phoenix here in San Diego. How do you find the time and the motivation to write so much and on such a variety of themes?
To me, it's all about commitments and priorities. I mean, essentially, I do what I value in my life and where I want to spend my time. Uh-huh. This means that I don't do a lot of things, but I rather do a few things that I try to do very well, like being an expert. And my life is a 24/7 life because I can write any time during the day or evening or any time during the week. I can control what I do, and I really, really like that. So I do what I do because I want to become good at it and not become a generalist.
So you have to cut back on leisure activities.
I come back on a lot of leisure activities and a lot of sleep because there's only 24 hours in this day to be able to do what I want to do.
So in a typical day, how many hours do you write?
I'll schedule my hours for the whole week, probably on a Sunday. So yesterday I looked at my calendar and asked myself, what are my projects for this whole week? Mm-hmm. And I've got essentially 2 projects going on in the area of writing. And I'll look at probably 2 or 3 hours each day committed to some form of writing or editing or researching in the projects that I'm working on.
Very organized. You've been called a prime example of someone who's re-careered himself. I mean, I know that in your former life, you were an Air Force officer and human resources executive. So how did you transition from that to author?
I was working in Northern California, specifically San Francisco, with a professional medical group, and I was the chief HR executive. Mm-hmm. But I felt at a point in time that I needed to switch. I had what I call the itch to switch. And I think everybody develops the itch sometime in their career,
right,
whether it's at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, or whatever. But I developed the itch. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do if I had left, changed the human resources executive role. So like any good business person, I did an inventory of who I was and what I wanted to be. And so I analyzed my skills and my strengths and my weaknesses and my passions and all the things that go into sort of a self-evaluation. And I figured that I could do a couple of things very well outside of corporate life. And there was one thing that I was petrified of doing that I thought it could become a developmental opportunity for me. So I gave myself the title of ACE. A-C-E.
Okay.
A stands for author, C stands for career coach, and E stands for educator. I could be a career coach and educator pretty easily, but I really was petrified of writing. So writing became my developmental opportunity that I decided to commit to. And today, 10 years later, I'm really spending most of my time doing the writing. So it was a business plan that I created, and I considered myself to be the business. And I needed to figure out how I could make money as me, as that person who runs the business.
So if we could say that some writers are born and some are made, you made yourself.
I made myself. I was not an avid writer or an avid reader in the day. In fact, even today, I don't do a lot of reading of full books. I do reading for purposes of research and for looking at how writers are able to tell a compelling story or develop compelling characters.
Craft. Well, I know you've written novels in a variety of genres, books on espionage, murder, love stories, ghost stories, and even a vampire trilogy. Which book did you enjoy the most writing and why? And is it difficult to cross types of books?
Yeah, I'm always asked this question about what my favorite book is. And so I will answer that in a sort of circular way. I have 2 favorite books. One is my first book. It's called The Tale from a Ghost Dance. I had no idea what I was doing when I was writing this book. I was experimenting with my writing style. I was experimenting with creating stories and characters. And it's probably, although the book is still in print, it is the worst crafted book of all time.
If you do say so yourself.
If I do say so myself, but I love it because I look at the books that I'm writing now and I can see the growth that I have been able to accomplish in my writing career. So my second favorite book will always be my last book because it shows what I'm really capable of doing. And that last book is called Scarlet Rose, And it just came out in January of this year.
I know that you've published independently, like so many authors are choosing to do in this new age. What made you go that route, and how do you market yourself?
I'm a control freak. I want to control what I do, and I want to own what I do. And the way to do that for me is look at independent publishing. Mm-hmm. So I'm with a print-on-demand publisher called Author Solutions. Essentially, I give them my manuscript, and I tell them what to do, how to put mm-hmm. it into a book format. I then pay them services for marketing, for editing, for all kinds of things that I would have to pay someone else to do if I was even with a traditional publisher. So the notion of independent publishing allows me to control what I want to do and market it in a way that I think is appropriate. And also, because I now do screenplays, because I own the novel, I can adapt that novel to a screenplay right. without asking permission from anyone.
Right. And do you have any screenplays that are being optioned? Or
I have 6 screenplays now being looked at in Hollywood. 5 of them are adapted from my novels. The 6th one, which is called Desperate, that just came out probably a month ago, mm-hmm. is an original screenplay. And the idea is to leverage the novel and the screenplay towards Hollywood.
One last question, Antonio. What are you writing now, and when will it be available?
I'm completing a novel called Crush. It's a suspense drama thriller novel. It's about telemarketing scams mm-hmm. and how this person overcomes a telemarketing scam. It probably will come out in January of next year.
Okay. Look forward to it. Our time is up, but thanks again for joining us. For more information on Antonio F. Viana, please visit his website at www.vianabooks4u.com, and that's the number 4 and the letter U. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you've been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.